Welcome to another week of DC Signal to Noise. I'm John Harris, News Director for Farm Journal, with the diviner of Signal to Noise, Jim Wiesmeyer, the policy analyst for Pro Farmer. And Jim, we need to mention that we did kind of a quiet launch last week of streaming this live. We had a whole lot of fun last week, so we're going to do it again. So we are streaming this live, and we'll continue to do so. So if you're listening on the podcast and want to get in on the live discussion, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Central, Friday afternoons, head to the AgriTalk Facebook page and join in on the conversation. So let's do it, Jim. Let's get to it because there's a lot going on. And again, for those just tuning in, make sure you post your comments there on Facebook and we will react to them as we go along. Okay. Where do I start this week, Jim? Should we talk about the continuing resolution and the fight to get Commodity Credit Corporation funding in there?
Yeah, it continued to amaze me, I would say, for the continuing resolution. Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, I think for the second consecutive year, flubbed up on this one, because you'll recall last year at this time, some of the Democrats wanted to block additional, or I should say replenishment of the Commodity Credit Corporation, you know, funding. And they did the same thing this year, but this time she really got pushback, not only from farm groups, but some of her own Democratic farm state lawmakers, and of course Republicans from from Mitch McConnell on down railed against it, because we just don't need politics in this one. So I think that was a unforced error on her part, but reason prevailed. And I think this is where grassroots shined again, because both the farm state lawmakers, the commodity groups, Farm Bureau, et cetera, convinced her and some other Democrats, including Senate Ag Committee Chairwoman, former Chairwoman Stabenow from Michigan. Both her and Pelosi initially called the CCC replenishment slush fund for Trump. And that could come back and be and haunting, you know, this topic, John, later on, I'd say in the next year or so.
Yeah, indeed. And that gets to some of the larger discussion that we'll get to in a minute about that we've been talking about on this show for weeks now, about the future of the farm bill and how the CCC figures into that. But back to the battle this week, it was remarkable to me. Initially, you had farm state Republicans coming out very strongly against the Democrats for keeping the CCC replenishment out of the continuing resolution. Then it was surprising to me that you saw such ferocious attacks from even some farm state Democrats about the Democrats' continuing resolution bill, because it did not include that CCC replenishment in it.
Well, they know how important the CCC is as a mechanism for farm program payments, not just the disaster aid, or I should say COVID aid, the trade mitigation, the conservation reserve program payments, ARC, PLC, et cetera. So they didn't buy that. And I thank goodness that this was a bipartisan approach to, facts and figures out there. Now, a number of Democrats also wanted additional billions of dollars for the nutrition programs, and they ended up getting it. So, they did get something out of this.
Hey, is the signal behind all of this, Jim, that Nancy Pelosi didn't necessarily, her intention never was really to exclude the extended authorization for the CCC, but instead was wanting to make a message about about that CCC money and the future of how it's used?
Well, she initially didn't want to, be a block, because if you recall, they had an agreement, and that's what surprised so many people when they pulled the agreement back. And, that's where you hide under, well, not everything was agreed to. So if everything isn't agreed to, nothing's agreed to. Well, that's noise, as we well know. They had a rethinking of this. But then I can imagine behind the scenes, I know know, Colin Peterson, what a more than whispered in her ear. Do you know what this is doing to me in my reelection drive, close reelection drive in Minnesota? A number of her other Democratic colleagues said, you know, we didn't get much for this $21 billion in food and nutrition. Initially, it was, what, $2.7 billion. They got more than a few billion dollars more. So I think it wasn't well thought out to begin with, John.
All right. Well, this now heads to the Senate, and they are pushing it to the wire in the Senate. They're not taking it to the floor until next week. Are there any potential snags in the Senate side?
Well, you always have grandstanders, but I think that they set up a procedural vote to have it either Tuesday at the earliest and no later than Wednesday. Of course, that's the countdown to shutdown. That will not happen, okay? This version of Republicans in the Senate, they still like to spend a lot of money. So it'll eventually be approved. And I did want to point out another clearly noise factor in this was when the House put in language prohibiting the use of CCC for cash payments to, quote, big oil. Pat Roberts had a good line. Senator Pat Roberts, Republican from Kansas, who is retiring, he said he couldn't find any language in the bill either for big oil or small oil or whatever. So this was just all noise. And earlier in the week, Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue had come out and said he doesn't have authority within the Commodity Credit Corporation to provide cash payments to the oil industry. But this was a show me language. So that's, you know, that's politics 101.
Yeah, but somebody was floating a trial balloon somewhere. We just don't know exactly what it was and what they were trying to accomplish, because Reuters had a source for that story that was, again, was trying to float some sort of idea for the oil industry.
Yeah, where Reuters was in the right church but wrong pew, they also quoted that it was going to come out of the CCC. And if you follow right, USDA, that smelled from the beginning. I'm still not going to rule out that they'll find money in some other area. There are so many back alleys of billions of dollars in the U.S. government funding mechanism. I had initially heard that it was going to come out of, quote, some Treasury Department account. So I'm still not going to rule it out happening.
All right. Well, while we're talking about funding and aid funding for agriculture, let's talk once again, as we do every week, about the prospects for a new COVID aid package. Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin are talking again. They are at least closer together on the final number, but I think still pretty far apart on details. Is there really any hope with everything else that's going on of this actually getting done?
There's some hope, but it's not very large as far as a number. The reason, the House in May passed a bill, let's call it $3.5 trillion aid and stimulus package. The Republicans didn't come anywhere close to that in their attempt. And then Pelosi again is being pressured by the what you could call a moderates in her party, that they're just less liberal, to get something because of the need for aid. Then it looked really pretty, like no chance. And then Thursday, yesterday, Mnuchin up on the Hill, said that he was continuing to talk with Pelosi and they would try to get a targeted approach. And that's when Pelosi directed her leaders of the committees to come up with another plan. And it looks like her line in the sand on this one is $2.4 trillion. But it's interesting how they'll probably come up with that figure. They're just going to shorten the timeline for some of the programs. So I don't know whether she gave all that much, but it will be a no-go for the Senate Republicans, who are already worried about the significant deficit and debt in this country. Now, finally, I do want to, for balance, yes, for balance, however, none other than the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, several times this week. I think he testified three different times just this week alone. And each time he really stressed the need for fiscal aid. That tells me he sees some potentially growing weaknesses in the U.S. economy. We saw the durable orders report come out today, much under pre-report guesstimates. So I'll usually bow to the Fed chairman rather than the politicians on both sides of the aisle. I think we do need some type of aid package, but probably targeted for sure. And that's really the White House position on this one. Targeted.
Yeah. Well, I can see where Chairman Powell is pushing this, though, because you've got a number of industries, most notably the airline and hotel industries, that up until this moment are still band-aided together by federal aid. If that goes away, you are going to see a very significant number of layoffs come on very suddenly from those industries if they aren't held back together by a new band-aid of some sort. So I imagine that's probably what's driving a lot of what Chairman Powell is pushing for there. I would think, though, Jim, that the White House would have a big political incentive for wanting to push for this, because what's better than sending out $1,200 checks to constituents with a nice letter from President Trump right before the election?
Well, you saw Trump, what was it, last week come out and say that he wanted more spending. So he got on a different plank on this issue than the Republican leaders in the Senate. Trump is spend happy. He's no Republican conservative, you know, when it comes to spending. And obviously, 1 + 1 = 2 on election time. He should want to pump as much money out in the farm country prior to the November, not just farm country, the U.S. country, prior to November 3rd election. So I don't think he'll be too anti any spending level.
All right. We'll go with the assumption that the Senate is going to approve the continuing resolution with the CCC funding in it, and the president will sign it. Assuming that happens, is there a drastic need at this point then for more ag aid in a COVID aid package? Or do we have most of what we need just out of that CCC funding?
I think you have most of what you need. However, there is some additional aid that is needed. And I'm not quite sure why they didn't put it in language in the continuing resolution or stopgap spending measure, because this gets into the indemnity funding that Secretary Perdue keeps saying he doesn't have authority for within the CCC. So all they would have had to do is put a line change in the stopgap spending measure that they didn't. And there are a couple of other avenues in the in a potential next aid package, maybe help for the ethanol refiners as well.
Yeah, but as you and I have been talking for weeks, that language that allows CCC money to go to indemnification for livestock really is key and needs to make it into language in something that's going to pass out of Congress in the very near future.
Absolutely. The hog industry really needs additional cash flow on this one, and that would help them out immensely.
All right. Given we've added a new layer to all of this in the last week with now the fight over the Supreme Court seat that was held by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, how does the discord over that fight impact all of these other issues that are important to agriculture?
For agriculture, I'm not quite sure, but overall, the visceral feelings that we even had before the Supreme Court opening has just been amplified. When they do have those hearings, it could be very ugly. Along the shades, and I hope I'm wrong, of the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, the Democratic leaders have already said they're going to pull out all stops on this one. What is that? The votes are already going to be there, so they could overplay their hand if they follow through with what they've already said. I just think it would be wise political process for them to just hear the candidate out and don't overreach, though that remains to be seen. But boy, you've got, again, the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, you know, Democrat from New York, saying, signaling, if you will, that they could pack the court if they were to win the White House and take control of the Senate, increasing that number from the 9 right now. If that's the case, this country is in even worse trouble than I think it is, because that's what then you would politicize, clearly politicize, you know, the Supreme Court. They're also threatening to, if the Democrats, you'll get in the White House and the Senate, to do statehood for the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. That would give them, in essence, 4 more senators. And so you can see the significance of those threats if they're carried out.
Indeed, and you're going to see those threats just continue to ramp up as this fight ramps up. An interesting aside, and before I get to that reminder, if you're watching us on the live stream here and want to join the conversation, drop a comment there and or a question, and we will address it here on DC Signal to Noise. Jim, an interesting aside to that Supreme Court fight is that Colin Peterson, ranking member of the House Agriculture Committee, put out an interesting press release yesterday calling for a constitutional amendment that would lock the number of Supreme Court justices at 9. Of course, it has, like almost any constitutional amendment, has no chance of making it through the process, certainly not within the current argument that we're in now. But I think it's a sign of just where he is in that fight in his district for reelection in trying to hold off attacks from the right and prop himself up in a district that's probably leaning a little more right than it has in the past.
Yes, I totally agree. And that's what we would call a message bill. He's clearly sending a message to his constituents in the 7th Congressional District in Minnesota that I'm not going for this pack the court, you know, business. And as usual, I think he's spot on this one, that you don't want to get into a jumping ball because, you know, just think about it. I can write a Saturday Night Live script on this one, if this were to be the case, and then flash to the year 2050, where the number of people on the Supreme Court are probably 45, you know, by that time, because the political parties would jump, you know, back and forth. It's just stupid. So hopefully that won't happen. Now, the Senate is another thing, whether or not, you know, they can make a case for statehood.
Yeah, indeed. And on the Supreme Court fight, I think a lot of the back and forth of the media assumes that the Democrats in the House could push that forward. But I mean, this, you know, this shows that there are Colin Petersons out there who would not go forward. I would say that you look at maybe a Steve Manchin in West Virginia, probably not, probably couldn't count on him as a vote for this. There's, if you and I thought long and hard about it, we could probably come up with enough to make it even questionable whether or not it could pass.
Yeah, you know, even if it takes a simple majority, yes, but the pressure would be severe. Manchin is an interesting one from West Virginia. Usually he'll talk a good game, and then in the last hour, he'll come around and vote the Democratic Party. So I want to see if he can cross that political aisle. He talks a good game, but I think history shows that he'll side with the Democrats on almost every controversial issue. But again, well, you know what? We've had 9 justices since 1869, I believe. President Roosevelt tried to pack the court in 1930 and then backed off when he knew he didn't have even the Democratic votes to do so. So history would tend to signal you just leave it alone and let the chips fall where they may. There is some debate whether they should put a year limit on how long a Supreme Court justice should serve. I think that's a fair debate to have.
It is a fair debate. In fact, we just got a question on that from Facebook. So thanks for sending that in. Again, if you got questions, post them there in the comments on Facebook. It is a fair debate to have, but it's difficult to come up with a number, isn't it? Because, I mean, let's face it, not everyone is in the same mental faculty at the same age. We've seen Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I don't think ever slowed down a second, no. even, you know, up until the day before her death, whereas compared to some others that we did see some significant decline in capability before they were no longer on the court. So it's difficult to come up with what that limit rightfully should be.
Well, do you have an age limit? That raises all sorts of issues there. Well, yeah. Do you have a number of years? But if there's an age limit, then what do we have? Someone, you know, appointed at the age of 25? You know, I mean, that's the silly right. stuff that can happen. Not that they couldn't do it at the age of 25, the way some of these people are intelligent nowadays. But still, yeah, it leads. What I just said is I think it's going to lead to more questions than answers. So it's probably the status quo is far better than doing any changes. So just like a balloon, if you press it in, it goes out the other side. So I just think leave it alone and just deal within the system that we have.
Indeed. All right. Let's get to some comments that Rob Johansson, the chief economist at USDA, made this week in a blog post about the farm economy. He says, you know, we've seen this coming as we have. I mean, we're over 5 years now into a decline in the farm economy, but the COVID-19 really accelerated some of the existing weaknesses within the farm economy.
Yeah, I always look at what base that any economist uses, because, you know, you can say whatever you want. And he did say from 2014 to 19, prices fell 44% for corn and 35% for beans. But if you recall the year 2012 and 2013, and then we had some follow on strength from those, you know, $6 corn year in 2012. So I think that that amplified his argument by picking those years. But I think he was fairly accurate when he went through his reasons that, you know, the cost of production was higher or only marginally lower during those years, even when corn prices went down 44%, and competitors ramped up production, the Black Sea countries, you know, South America, which caused oversupply. So I think he laid it out pretty good, and he acknowledged that with CFAP 1 and 2 and trade aid and the recent surge in exports, it's helped, but it's hard to tell, he said, whether the tough times are over for farmers or more still lie ahead. That means he doesn't know.
So does the basis for his argument make the argument for supply side management?
No, not for supply side management, but given, as we wrote in Pro Farmer on the front page, given the uncertainties ahead, even with the solid demand that we're seeing from China, my kitty, and the U.S. ag outlook is dependent on government aid, as is the U.S. economy in general. So I think that's what it says. We don't know. And until we can get the market price to give more to the farmer rather than income transfer payments, we're going to have continued income transfers from the taxpayers to the ag sector. And I don't think agriculture has anything to be shy about on this because of the strategic nature of food and production of food.
But it is starting to grab the attention of the WTO member nations.
It is. And even amongst farmers, I get a lot of emails saying, how long can this continue? With the financial situation in the U.S., I started getting questions, could there be potential fraud in some of these programs? I emailed USDA earlier this week, and they said, as with any program, they have spot checks, X percent in X, you know, states and things like that. So they'll look at that. As far as the World Trade Organization, they've raised the question like, wow, this stuff is starting to add up. We had a former USDA top economist, Dr. Joe Glauber, really smart guy, personal friend. He's saying our amber box payments are now around double of the maximum they should be of $19.1 billion is our cap. So this is a bona fide issue to be discussed within the World Trade organization, even though I think, again, a case can be made that this country had to protect not just farmers, but the food industry all through the process, John. So, you know, let the debate begin.
Yeah, a little throwback for you there with the Amber Box reference there. Haven't heard that in a few years now. Well, and ag groups this week were very vocal in a united letter to the administration, voicing support for the importance of the WTO to U.S. agriculture.
Well, that's like in anything. And for this great country, we have, we think, the rule of law. Some demonstrators who, if you want to demonstrate, fine. If you want to loot, that's against the law. But you do need a rule of law when it comes to trade, too. And there's where the discussion is. Is this really balanced within the World Trade Organization now? Is it tilted more toward the developing countries? Is it tilted more toward even labeling China as a developed, developing country? That's a joke in and of itself that should be changed. And both President Trump and U.S. Trade Rep Bob Lighthizer say that the dispute resolution system needs more muscle behind it. Other than that, they just see this going awry. So we're going to have substantial reform. I applaud the farm groups from taking a stance that they did, because in many commodities, the difference between profit and loss in years is the export situation. That's especially true in the meat sector.
Yeah, and it's difficult to see at times, because it does seem like the more that the U.S. is on the losing side of WTO challenges more than it's on the winning side, but there are uncounted instances of items that never come to a challenge because of the recognition of WTO rules. The biggest weakness is what you just pointed to, is when you have an actor like China that doesn't even act within the framework of where the rules sit, and the WTO has no mechanism to take on things like technology transfer and some of those other, put it quite bluntly, theft issues with China. And I think that's where it's left the WTO very weak in not being able to take on those very real trade issues.
Absolutely. And I can't speak for Lighthizer, but I can tell you what he has said in the past. Even the cases, many cases, not all, that the U.S. has won relative to the WTO, in more than a few cases, the successful conclusion that we got was not acted on totally. So where is the reform needed in order to make sure that even countries who win cases, that they're rectified, you know, within the conclusion of the dispute resolution? So it just needs to be totally reformed. Now, you have to have the U.S. as part of that in order to do it, because of our clout on that. But the U.S. wants to assurances that the other countries, especially the European Union, will not bow to the proclivities of Brazil and India, which in the past have overtaken the WTO and have had way too much clout than they deserve to have.
Yeah, but again, to underscore, if you do away with the WTO, like the Trump administration seems to be inclined to want to do, or at least with U.S. membership of it, you lose that protection of the framework of the WTO for those issues that never even come to a dispute resolution with the WTO, that just because the members agree to trade under those parameters, that you avoid certain disputes and certain giving countries advantages over each other.
I totally agree. I'd rather, again, the rule of law, I think, has merit, and I'd rather be with the WTO than without it.
All right, Jim, let's turn to ethanol. Coming off of the announcement that the EPA was going to deny the gap year waivers, now they are pushing legislation introduced by Sherry Bustos out of Illinois, promoting essentially setting a minimum octane level for gasoline, dictating that you can't increase carbon to meet that octane level. So in effect, increasing the demand for ethanol. What do you think about this approach?
I think it's spot on and should have been done years ago. I remember, and I told this on AgriTalk years ago, sitting in Colin Peterson's office where he basically outlined this approach. And he said, you know, E25 and E30 is the sweet spot. And that gives you that, well, you know, what is it, 98% octane standard. And that would generate more corn and ethanol demand, plus establish you as to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, John. We should have been there, but I'm not going to be negative on this. Let's go forward in this. And I think this should be part of the ethanol and biofuels and farm state lawmakers' initiatives as we begin the debate in 2021 on what happens to the renewable fuel standard program once its authorization ends in the year 2022. This is an excellent start.
Yeah, and it helps automakers make more efficient, smaller engines with higher horsepower because they can increase compression. If you've got if you raise the entire octane of the entire feedstock that's out there, I mean, I know in my car, it's a little 2-liter four cylinder that puts out 250 horsepower because it uses high octane fuel in higher compression.
Yeah. With the turbo and other aspects, a four cylinder becomes a six cylinder in the old days, and a six becomes an eight. And this E25 and E30, it just makes the thrust far more efficient. So I think we're finally getting the logic here, and let's hope it's followed through. I think it will happen. You know, by the way. So I think this would be agriculture's contribution, if you will, one of several that I see coming in the years ahead, for the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And hopefully the oil industry will go in concert with this because they're showing signs they have long-term problems as well. And it's called electric vehicles, John.
The point I was just going to bring up, this is the opportunity, probably the last opportunity for the oil and biofuels industries to work together to really save the liquid fuel industry. If there is to be any sort of long-term future for that, because in order to face the challenge presented by electric vehicles, and I'm not saying that a future of electric vehicles is bad. I think it's laudable to look at reducing emissions. But the ethanol and oil industries have a chance to do that with liquid fuels as well, if they would work together. But I just don't see where we've been the last few years. I don't see those industries seeing that path forward together and seeing what that mutual interest is.
Boy, they need to talk to automobile owners of shops that I have. And they're worried as heck for their future on gas, gas fueled cars. You saw California Governor Gavin Newsom announce his state. He wants to plan for the sale of all new gasoline. He wants to ban the sale of all new gasoline fueled cars after 2035. And some of the estimates I've seen this week, by the year 2035 in the world, you're going to have 50% of cars be electric vehicles, and 80% by 2050. These are smart people doing these prognostications. And so the batteries are going to get cheaper and cheaper and go further and further. So technology is on the side of the electric vehicles. And as I've said before, history is going to repeat. In my studies, it took us 20 years from the really start of an industry like the horse and buggy days. It took 20 years to move that horse from the middle of the road to the side of the road. So the clock is ticking on this. And if Biden were to become president, he's already said he favors electric vehicles. He supports corn-based ethanol as well. But he also says that he wants to dramatically support a nationwide system of recharging batteries. And that was the one Achilles heel of the corn-based ethanol industry years ago, that they didn't have the right strategy long-term through planned enough. Because if you recall, at the time, there was one major, at the time, ethanol group, the Renewable Fuels Association. that's when you started to see growth energy come. And when you look at the history of growth energy, they really started as a result of frustrations within the ethanol community that the logistics, the infrastructure, wasn't in place, the right pumps, the wells, etc. So this goes back to even that. So if the electric vehicles can get their infrastructure done, that's another chink in that long-term market for them, John. So I think what we're witnessing right now, several years from now, is going to be considered a very, very big issue that we saw, develop in the year 2020. So I think what's happening right now is very important to the energy sector, to the biofuel sector, and to the battery sector.
Yeah, and as you said on AgriTalk this morning, quoting the famous quote from Watergate is, follow the money. And the money right now, whether it's investment money, whether it's the big three automakers, whether it's the price of Tesla stock, other startups coming up in the industry, all of the money is going towards electric vehicles. And for me, the watershed moment is when they can get to 300 mile range on a 15-minute charge at a cost of $35,000 for a vehicle. And we're not all that far off from now. Once you get to that point, below, you're really in parity with gas automobiles.
Are below. Tesla's leader said he wants to come up with a $25,000 price. To me, it's not a question of if, it's when. And because of the technology of this battery and electric vehicles, that's where the investment money is going. Not just in this country, John. Look at China, the number one leader in EVs, Europe, etc. And I read another report there very early this morning that say in not too many years that Volkswagen will be number one in the EVs. I think number two was going to be Toyota, and they put Tesla number three, General Motors number four. Revolutionary changes is going to go on. The ethanol industry should absorb this for the reasons that we said before. They can come up with a very good liquid fuel for all the cars that remain for a while on that highway system relative to the dramatic growth in the years ahead for EVs.
Yeah, and there will be many that remain. Because there's car aficionados out there that will always be driving liquid fuel, but that share is going to continue to shift as the years go on. Before we leave ethanol, ethanol groups have still been pounding on the president pretty hard this week about waivers and the renewable fuels standard, even though we saw those gap year waivers rejected last week. Jim, are you surprised that push is still continuing?
No, they're good complainers, So if there's consistent on one thing, it's that. I don't blame them. They've been burnt so many times. But and you think President Trump is not going to get this question when he campaigns in Minnesota, hopefully in Iowa and other Midwest states? So he better be ready for that question, because he's going to get it.
Yeah, he is. He is indeed. You noted just a quick note in one of your email newsletters this morning. And before we get to that, how can people get your email newsletter?
Profarmer.com. Sign up for it.
There you go. It's the best, most informative thing you're going to get in the morning. Please do sign up for it at profarmer.com. But you had just a quick note on something that, again, we've been talking about for weeks here, but I have a feeling you've distilled it even further, and that is the discussion of the next farm bill is already ongoing.
Well, you saw that in several instances lately, but it was within the continuing resolution, the stopgap spending bill. The Democrats, they were unnamed, but they wanted to put more management or restrictions on the use of the Commodity Credit Corporation funding. And Senator Pat Roberts railed against that, I was told, and said, that's like reopening the farm bill. Well, in a roundabout way, that was opening the farm bill. They had a mini debate, but this tells me that in the next farm bill, that has already started, that is going to be one of the debates. What parameters do you put on the use of USDA's ATM, you know, machine, which is called the Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act. I think it's needed, but I wouldn't leave it just up to an administration or a top economist at USDA. They should have a role in it, but I like when the subcommittees and the committees and the House and Senate Agriculture Committee have a say. And it looks like that's going to be open for debate, coming up in the next farm bill.
And I think it's probably worth noting that Pat Roberts will not have a voice in that as he's retiring at the end of this term. And as we discussed earlier, there is some likelihood that Colin Peterson, who's been the other strong voice on this, might not be a part of that conversation if he does not survive this political challenge that he has this time around.
Yeah, it's going to be a close contest, and that depends on how many people come out and vote for president in the state of Minnesota, because Trump needs Minnesota, it looks like, those 10 electoral votes. So I would say the more people that come out to vote, that you got to lower the odds that, Colin will be reelected. But boy, the vast majority of farm groups and farmers I know in the 7th Congressional District like Colin Peterson. That means they don't that they dislike his competitor, Michelle Fischbach. But Colin has gone to the mat for sugar producers over the years. He comes from the biggest sugar producing district in the U.S. And Colin knows, he's an accountant by training, and I've seen him look at a CCC spreadsheet. I mean, how many lawmakers can do that? And he can pick out certain illogical things, which isn't hard to do, actually. Mm-hmm. But he can pinpoint them on that. And he's just been one of the premier lawmakers when it comes to, as we said before, the ethanol industry. He knows that industry. So, yeah, that would hurt. I want to also say that I think we're getting evidence here of the farm bill debate in the past. And I will promise the listeners and the viewers that we will have Frank Lucas, the former House Ag Committee chairman, who was the chairman of the House Ag Committee for the 2014 Farm Bill, yes. I want to say. I might be wrong on the year. And that's when Frank Lucas tried to tell some farm state lawmakers and groups that they would rue the day that they didn't look at the farmer safety net is a true safety net rather than going for a shallow loss payment program. Because what few people apparently don't know is you could have had a much higher reference price for corn, around $4 or so, and soybeans had it not been for those two types of programs that we now have, the ARC and PLC. So I think a trip back to history is very inclusive here, because it would have been a far better safety net when times are really bad, such as now, John. So I want to get him back because, to me, the farm bill debate has started, and I want to have his counsel as we go into the beginning rounds of the next farm bill debate. And I promise you that.
Well, you bring up a good point. I mean, isn't this a good time for the farm bill debate for the economic benefit of farmers, as opposed to a 2014 when you didn't have the strong need for farm programs?
Absolutely. That's why we had the greed, if you will, of the shallow loss payment program. And I've always said you got to determine how wide the holes are in that safety net. Well, it's been found wanting. Again, to be fair, no farm program could cope with what we've been through relative to the COVID-19 situation and the U.S.-China trade war. So you're always going to have exceptions to the rule. That's why you need a very flexible Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act in concert with the lawmakers. So I think we're seeing the mergings of a policy develop here for emergency purposes. And Colin Peterson has already said he doesn't want to go through this again if we have another emergency. You should have a known tool to use rather than the whims of a president in a tweet announcing, such and such, $1 billion is available. So I think we'll learn what we've gone through from the higher price years and the very low priced years. And then you can develop a policy that will better not perfectly, better handle situations like that. So again, I can't wait for the coming debate, because we have real life examples of what works and what doesn't, John.
All right. And Jim, you had a note here that I meant to bring up earlier, and I apologize I didn't get to it in the earlier COVID aid discussion, but it's with CFAP 2 oversight. I know with the PPP program in particular, we saw some instances where that money did not end up where taxpayers necessarily would have expected it to end up. Because of that, are we going to see some spot checking on CFAP 2?
Absolutely. And I contacted Farm Service Agency. They said, like we do all major farm programs, we will have spot checks. They haven't determined the percentage of spot checks they're going to do, but that will come out. And they should be, because the taxpayers should want oversight on any particular program, especially now with this one, where they're going to spend $13.2 billion. There better be oversight. And again, with the financial pressures in farm country, it just usually leads to some skullduggery from the vast minority of participants in the program. But better they find it out within USDA than some Washington Post or anti-farm program activist group. So I think spot checks are always needed in any taxpayer program.
Yeah, indeed. All right, you had a note here about FAS glitch in sales announcements. What's that about?
They put it out at 8:32. It's supposed to come out at 8:30 Eastern time. I'm sorry, 9 o'clock Eastern time, daily export sales. It came out here. I get my email. All of a sudden, 8:32, I get a flash of a daily export sale, 100,000 tons of soybean meal to unknown destinations. And I said, what happened here? Is it an error, or did they jump the gun? As it worked out to be, I suspected it was their timing. You know, that when you're only as good as the operator releasing the right time frame. Every Thursday, FAS puts out the weekly export sales report at 8:30. So it was a glitch that way. So, but FAS has had a number of glitches this past year. So they probably need to have another meeting to true up and talk about quality of their release times and things like that. But it can happen. I understand that computer person error in not setting the right time back from 8:30 to 9 o'clock. But it can impact markets. Had that been a much higher, say we had 1.5 million corn sale to China and 2 million tons soybean sale, that could have if you weren't ready at that screen or on your computer to see that could have made some inroads and getting winners and losers and you know for that information.
Indeed. All right, Jim, I want to wrap up with a discussion about the presidential race and the first debate next week. Before I do that, I think it's worthy of note, and I noticed this as I was making out my list, China's not anywhere on that list this week. That's remarkable.
It is. And for the first time, my daily policy updates, I did not have a section to fill in for China. Now, China news was there relative to what Rob Johansson said with their robust sales. He mentioned sales, right. But he mentioned the solid demand from China, et cetera. But that was just shocking to me when I said, well, I looked all around. I said, is there any new China news? Usually that's when something happens significantly over the weekend, by the way, John, the history. Now, I'm not predicting the signal is for me to look for, because that's what's happened in the past too many times. Not all the time, but frequently that happens when you think that it's kind of leveling out, another shoe drops. So I'm going to be looking this weekend.
All right, we'll be watching for that, Jim. All right, let's wrap up with the presidential race. First of all, first debate coming up Tuesday. Before I give my perspective on it, what do you think they need each candidate to do Tuesday, Jim?
To not viscerally discuss the issues. And I know that they put out the number of topics that they're going to discuss, and they're pretty good. I noticed climate change was not on the list. And I know the Democrats are already saying climate change should be part of every presidential debate. I would look for Biden to find more than one time to weave climate change into his comments, because there is a vast difference between the two candidates on that particular topic. On Trump, he's got the command being president and being more than a hands-on president. He's got a command of the topic. So, but sometimes when you know a topic so well, you can get too confident. So I will look for it to see whether or not he can tone down, if that's even possible, for, you know, President Trump. I'm going to look for the fluidity or the lack thereof of, you know, Joe Biden. But as I said on AgriTalk, when I did my research on him, he was a stutterer, a very bad stutterer when he was young. And you never truly get over that. I know, because I used to stutter as a child. I got over most of it. And now, so I feel for him in that regard, because your mind's going very fast and you can't get it out of your mouth. So I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I want to see how prepared he is. And he doesn't have to be a Reagan or an Obama orator, but he has to be consistent in his thoughts and hopefully can get them out. So that's what I'm going to be looking for. We know the differences, you know, between the two. It's how each one of them are articulate without overreaching.
Yeah, from my perspective, I think both of them have to be pretty aggressive coming out of the gate, because it's going to be key for either of them to get the other off their game. Donald Trump only works on offense. He doesn't work at all on defense. And so Joe Biden's got to find some way to get him on defense. That's going to be difficult, because as we've seen, Donald Trump is never grounded in, he never feels the need necessarily to respond to something that's thrown at him unless it challenges him at the most personal level. And he's not grounded in truth by any stretch either. So it is difficult to find some way that puts him on the defense. That's going to be the challenge put before Joe Biden, because if Donald Trump stays on offense through the night, it's going to be very difficult for Joe Biden, which is why Donald Trump needs to be on offense out of the gate to make Joe Biden, quite frankly, stumble and reinforce the notion that he's put forward about Joe Biden. So I think it could be a bare-knuckled brawl on Tuesday night.
It could well be, and that's why I think the ratings will be quite high, you know, for that one. And but the Democrats know how to goad our president. He's easy to goad. So they'll try all throughout, you know, that debate. One of them is, will you accept the results of the election? And you saw how he keeps different answers, you know. And I know we have a back page special on the latest policy issues, and one of the editors of Pro Farmer texted me, and she said, well, didn't they come out and say that he would abide by the results? And I told him, well, for maybe the latest hour he said that, but unless he issues an executive order saying that, I don't believe it, because he's changed too many times on that. But there's one, John, that Trump went over, because his own political party leaders in Congress chided him. They pushed back at him of saying this great country will, any president will or should abide by the results. And Trump just said, well, we'll see, and we'll see what the Supreme Court says. So that signals to me he's going to, this thing, if it's close, could well go all the way to the Supreme Court.
I think it has connecting. I think
I'm
he's
sorry.
Try.
Yeah, it has to be close.
I don't think it has to be close. I think he's going to try whatever he can, even if it's not close.
Yeah, well, there. Hopefully, well, then you know, there you go. Well, doesn't need something like that. But let's. I think if it's not close, that takes. We'll see. I think he's using these mail potential mail fraud and think as a overt cover right away in case he does lose. That's Trump 101. Always build your case that you didn't really lose. It was the system. But I just hope that the spirit of the past were both political parties. I mean, look at the contentiousness that we had with Biden Bush. And where I know Biden didn't want to give right away, what, it took a month or so? But this is an issue, and I want to see how Trump Tuesday night answers that question, that I know the integrity of elections is the topic. And I want to see if Trump nuances that at all. Because really, their audience, John, is the just right around 13%. Of the truly independent voter who still is up for grabs. And you have to be presidential. You have to be articulate. You have to give that potential swing voter the opportunity to say, okay, they made a coherent case and I'm going to vote for him. That's what's that's what's so important Tuesday evening. And if Biden were to go okay in the Cleveland debate, I think he's in myself, but because Trump, there's been so much low expectations of Hyden Biden, you know, things like that, that if he can just be consistent and fluid in his remarks, you're going to see that bump in the poll. If he isn't, and Trump is more presidential, Trump could get a bump, you know, in the surveys, following, you know, the first debate. First debate is going to be the most important one.
I think you're more hopeful about the debate than I am, Jim. I think if it is a normal debate in this year, it's not going to have much impact on outcome. As we've talked about this before, I really think that the two camps are pretty well entrenched at this point. To your point, if one of them comes across very presidential, it may provide some cover for some really squishy people in the middle, which there aren't many of those left at this point, but it might provide some cover for them to say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and vote for this guy because he looked more presidential in the debate. But I really think there's not much hope for impact from this debate unless something monumental happens. And we've seen those moments in debates where that's happened, but I don't know that we can guarantee that on Tuesday night.
You can't guarantee it, but we agree to disagree. I think this is going to be a biggie, the first one. So, again, from Biden's case, if he can get by from being articulate on the issues, it remains to be seen. And for Trump, if he doesn't overdo it. And now if both of them succeed, then okay, I'll grant you that it's going to take maybe not just an additional debate, but their campaigns. But I just don't believe the polls right now. I don't think they accurately capture the Trump voter out there. The same thing happened in 2016, and I don't think these pollsters have updated their methodology. They say they have. I got to see it to believe it.
I agree with you there. I don't know if the polls that we're seeing right now are telling the full story either, but I think that this election is pretty well baked at this point. We just don't know which cake is coming out of the oven.
Yeah. Now, are you going to announce yet? Can we announce on this program that we're going to be live the election night?
Huh? Yeah, you and I are going to hop on this platform 10 p.m. Eastern on 9 p.m. Central on election night. We may or may not know anything at that point, and we'll talk about what we do and don't know at that point in the evening. It'll be the same format where you can chime in and ask us questions while we're doing it. And we may even have some surprise guests during that time.
Some surprise guests we're working on, so stay tuned on that one.
All right, so yeah, make plans for election night. And you and I are going to provide some commentary on agweb.com all through the night as well. Sure. So be sure to be watching agweb.com on election night for both that ongoing commentary through the evening and then the live discussion at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. All right, Jim, where are you watching for signal this next week?
Oh, well, China all the time, whether or not there's a bombshell over the weekend. Second one is preparing for the debate on Tuesday, and third, covering the Senate on their very likely acceptance of the House passed bill. And the last one is whether or not we can up the odds whatsoever of getting a next COVID aid and stimulus package. That's enough right there, John.
Yeah, and those are all big ones. But in particular, I think a lot of people are going to be watching what happens in Congress on that COVID aid package and whether there's still a prayer for that. Jim Smith, thanks for the comment. We're looking forward to election night as well. We appreciate that. And thanks, everybody, for joining us this week. Again, a reminder, if you're listening on the podcast and you want to watch this live and participate next Friday, tune in to the AgriTalk Facebook page. You can go to the AgWeb Facebook page, too. We have it there, but we encourage people to go to the AgriTalk Facebook page, join in the conversation, and give us a chat. And appreciate it. Jim, as always, great insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer. I'm John Harris from Farm Journal. That wraps up this week's edition of DC Signal to Noise.